Okay, so we'll start with Mark, who will tell us about the first 3 million years, and then after coffee break, Genevieve will tell us about the next 100 million years.
Right. I was sort of amused this morning when people talked about really young star clusters that are only 10 million years old, because in my world, 10 million years, we're no longer interested. You know, that's old, that's dead, that's boring. So I should begin by issuing the general warning, I am not a globular cluster person. And so I work on star formation in a more sort of galactic, local galaxy context. And so what I'm going to try and do is tell you what I think is the sort of current theoretical understanding of star formation in the sense of star clusters in the Milky Way and Milky Way-like environments. And then I'll sort of leave it as more of a discussion question of how we scale that up to globular cluster sizes. So I should just begin by pointing out my collaborators, and one I will call attention to in particular is Stella Offner, who is a graduate student who is finishing as we speak, and took time out from writing her thesis to send me some nice pictures I can show, but I will point her out when we get to her. So here are the sort of three lessons I wish to impart, and again, I don't know for certain if these apply to formation of globular clusters, but they are something that we see based on star formation in the local universe. And the first is star clusters, like all stars, form in a slow process. And I'll clarify what I mean by slow when we get to it. The second thing I want to point out is that feedback matters a lot. And feedback here is not just supernovae. I know people who think about galaxies and don't think about star-forming regions tend to say feedback, oh, that means supernovae. In fact, supernovae are probably not the most important form of feedback for the formation of star clusters. And so I will get into that. And finally, I'm going to end on the purely speculative note that the IMF is still something of a riddle, and there is some evidence for variation of the IMF at the high mass end, and that, of course, may have impacts that go beyond the first 10 million years, although I'll let someone else worry about those. So I'm hoping your reaction to my talk will not be along these lines. This is, in fact, perhaps the proper attitude of a theorist towards observations in general. And I'm a theorist, so I understand. Nonetheless,
this is great. Where did you get this from?
This is actually on a temple in Japan. I did not take this picture, but this is from a temple in Japan. If you do Google image search, you can find all sorts of great things to put in your talks. All right, so lesson one, star formation is slow, and here's what I mean. So if you look at the Milky Way disk, we've got about 10 to the 9 solar masses of gas organized into giant molecular clouds. And the typical density in these clouds is of order 100 hydrogen nuclei per cubic centimeter, and if you work out what free fall time that corresponds to, it's about 4 million years. And now you say, well, all right, suppose I think that these giant molecular clouds are more or less just falling into stars as fast as they could. They're in free fall collapse. Well, what would the star formation rate in the Milky Way be? And you do long division, and you get about 300 solar masses a year or thereabouts. The observed star formation rate in the Milky Way is more like 3 solar masses a year. So there's a factor of 100 discrepancy between the star formation rate you would expect if things were just collapsing in free fall and the star formation rate you actually observe. And if you repeat this exercise for the giant molecular clouds in nearby galaxies, you come up with about that same ratio. You even come up with that ratio if you scale up to something that's a starburst. So here's ARP 220. It's our sort of favorite local starburst. ARP 220's ISM has a mass of about 2 times 10 to the 9 solar masses. It's actually very similar to the mass of the ISM in the Milky Way. It's just squished into a much smaller area. ARP 220 is sort of what you'd get if you took the entire ISM of the Milky Way and compressed it into the central 500 parsecs of the galaxy. And so the density is something like 10 to the 4 per cubic centimeter, and so the free fall time is a factor of 10 smaller, 0.4 million years. And again, you do long division, and you say, if ARP 220 were forming stars at the sort of free fall rate, you'd have a star formation rate of 5,000 solar masses a year. And the observed star formation rate in ARP 220 is about 50 solar masses a year. So again, even looking at this starburst, this system that's vastly denser and where sort of everything is forming in clusters, the star formation rate is a factor of 100 below the free fall rate.
But you turn it into a time scale, of course, it could also be that 1% of the gas by mass is going into stars at a free fall rate.
You could say that. That's right. I'm only telling you what fraction of the gas is going into source at the density this is sampling. But thank you for that segue. You could say that. So here's how you check it. So the way you check it is you say, well, all right, that's the sort of ISM as a whole. Now let me ask, well, all right, could it be the case that, in fact, 1% of the mass is going into stars at the free fall rate and the rest is just sitting there? So the way you check that is you say, well, all right, let me look at denser gas. All right, because presumably the stuff that's going into stars at the free fall rate is going to be the densest stuff. So you can check that using different tracers of the molecular gas. So on the left here, I have a plot for CO. And this is for two nearby galaxies, but you can put other galaxies on this plot, and you get the same thing. So on the x-axis here, I have the surface density of the molecular gas, and this is gas traced by the CO molecule, so that's a mean density of around 100 per cc. And on the y-axis, I have the star formation rate per unit area, and of course, you divide these two, and that gives you a time scale associated with star formation. It's called the depletion time. That is, the amount of time it would take to turn all of the gas into stars at the current star formation rate. And you see that it's about a gigayear. All right, and that turns out to be, if you put it in terms of freefall times, about 100 freefall times, as I said. All right, so that's CO. We can repeat this exercise with HCN. So HCN is a molecule that's got a critical density of about 10 to the 5 per cubic centimeter. So what you're seeing when you look at the HCN luminosity is just the amount of mass in the galaxy that's at a density higher than 10 to the 5 per cc. All right, and you can turn this LHCN into an estimated mass, and you can turn this LIR into an estimated star formation rate. And again, you just divide the two and you get a time scale. And for the HCN, it turns out to be about 30 million years. All right, and I should point out that on this plot, up here at these high luminosities, these are entire galaxies. Down here, these dots represent individual protocluster gas clouds in the Milky Way. So these are things that are sort of a parsec or a few parsecs in size within the Milky Way. These are entire galaxies, and you see they very clearly fit on the same correlation. All right, so in effect, this is just a large collection of these little things. Well, all right, so you say, well, maybe these things are, in fact, collapsing into gas on a free, or collapsing into stars on a free fall time scale. And so you say, well, all right, I've got the depletion time. How does that compare to the free fall time? Well, you know the density here is going to be about 10 to the 5, because that's the only way you see HCN 1 to 0 emission. And so you compute the free fall time at a density of 10 to the 5, and you divide. And the answer is still about 100 free fall times. So the depletion time is much shorter. It's 30 million years instead of a gigayear. But the freefall time is much shorter, too. And when you put those factors together, you come up with the same ratio. So I've done this for CO and HCN here, but it's possible to do this for a wide variety of tracers of star formation. And the answer is always the same. All right, so what I've plotted here is this ratio of freefall time to depletion time on the y-axis. And on the x-axis, the sort of characteristic density that a particular tracer tells you about. So this is CO1 to 0. It tells you about giant molecular clouds with densities of 100. Here's HCN. It tells you about gas at a density of 10 to the 5. Here are infrared dark clouds. This is a set of structures that are observed in the Milky Way in infrared absorption against the galactic background. And you can do a similar sort of calculation for them. This is an individual star cluster, the Orion Nebula cluster. The errors on that should probably be larger than they are. All right, and this is an upper limit from a tracer of even denser gas, CS5 to 4. And what you can see is that the data, you know, with some scatter, are basically all a percent. So there seems to be a universal star formation rate of about 2% of the mass or 1% of the mass per freefall time. So it's a universal star formation rate in the sense that if you normalize to the freefall time or the dynamical time of the cloud you're looking at, you always get this number of about a percent. So that's what I mean when I say that star cluster formation is a slow process. Even if we look at gas at a density of 10 to the 5, and that's something that's definitely making star clusters, because if you look at these little HCN lumps in the Milky Way, you can see the star clusters forming within them. You still find that they're turning themselves into stars at a rate of only about a percent of the mass per dynamical time. Now, this has a number of important implications, and one of them involves star cluster age spreads. So we think that the star formation efficiency, in the sense of what fraction of the mass do you turn into stars, p period over the entire star formation process, for star clusters, is sort of 10 to 30%. All right, and if you want to come up with anything that's got a bound remnant, you need of order 30% of the mass to go into stars, at least. Now, if the star formation rate is about 2% per freefall time, that means to get to this, well, it's like 5 to 15 freefall times. So what that means is that the age spread, that is, if you look at how long did the star cluster take to form, should be about that long. And lo and behold, here is the cluster IC348. So what is plotted on this histogram is the number of stars as a function of age. And this is just by pre-main sequence HR diagrams. That is, you make an HR diagram for the cluster, you draw pre-main sequence evolutionary tracks on it, and you just see how many stars fall into each age bin. What you see is, well, here's the 0 to 1 million year, 1 to 2, 2 to 3. So what you get is that, you know, the age spread here looks like it's sort of 2.5 million years. You know, 2 to 3 million years is the formation time.
Is
yes.
there mass dependency in age spread?
I do not think IC348 has enough stars that you would very confidently want to try and break it up this way. And in particular, for massive stars, it's almost impossible to put them on this diagram because they reach the main sequence so quickly that, you know, for a massive star, it's on the main sequence in less than a million years, and you can't age date it at all.
And theoretically, do you expect any mass dependence?
I would say that theoretically, no one knows the answer to that question. Generally, I'd say probably not, but this is something where there's no good understanding.
But you would generally expect the more massive stars to form first.
No, not necessarily. People have argued for massive stars first, massive stars last, and massive stars in between. And I would say that no one has a convincing argument one way or another, is I guess what I would say.
But there is no remnants yet in this particular.
No, this entire thing is, you know, this entire cluster is, you know, 2.5 million years old. So everything's still in the main sequence. You know, even the most massive stars haven't left the main sequence yet.
So you naturally get this 3 mega years such that if you had formed the most massive star that's going to explode first initially, this is just enough time that basically everything gets formed before the first supernova.
Well, in this case, but actually for IC348, that's a relatively low mass cluster. I am sure there is no star in IC348 that's going to go supernova in 3 million years. All right, the first super...
Just because you haven't populated...
Exactly. The IMF isn't populated high enough. You know, there may be... I'm not even sure there is any star in IC348 that's going to go supernova, period. All right. But you can repeat this exercise for other clusters. So, you know, Rho Ophiuchus, the Orion Nebula cluster, and you come up with about the same answer. All right, that is, the age spread is of order, you know, 10-ish freefall times. All right, which is what you expect, again, based on the observed star formation rate and the observed star formation efficiency. So can we understand where this comes from? Why is the star formation rate per freefall time of order a percent? So there's a clue here if you look at the structure of interstellar gas clouds. All right, and so here's an example of one. This is the Pipe Nebula. And it's imaged here in near-infrared extinction. So the idea of this technique is you look at a gas cloud in the near-infrared and you find the stars behind it. And for each star, you can try and assign an extinction based on its reddening and how much it's darkened. And that gives you the column along that line of sight. And if you do that for enough stars, you can, based on all of those columns, construct a map. So that's what was done here. And you see there are these little dense cores. There are all these little things that are circled. So those are the things that you say, ah, well, maybe that's the progenitor of a star. And the interesting thing about this is by mass, these cores are about 1% of the mass. 99% of the mass is in this fluffy gray stuff out here. It's in the envelopes and not the cores. And so maybe that's a clue about where this 1% per freefall time comes from. Now, the interesting thing is we know that gas clouds like this are extremely supersonically turbulent. They're dominated by supersonic turbulent motions. And if you do simulations of supersonic turbulence, you get a very, very similar structure. So this is an MHD turbulence simulation with a Mach number of 10. And again, you see the structure. There are these little dense cores. And that's where you think gravity's taking over, stars might form, but they constitute a negligible fraction of the mass, about 1%. By mass, it's all in this diffuse, fluffy gray stuff. So that suggests that the turbulence is maybe where this 1% comes from.
But so, then you need also a mechanism to actually replenish this 1% every time again you formed stars out of this 1%. So you had the 2nd%, the 3rd%, and so on.
I agree with that. And the nice thing is that because you've got this turbulent velocity field that's constantly generating shocks and putting material at high density, and you expect that to sort of statistically repopulate itself on order of a crossing time scale, you get exactly that. You know, these things will collapse, and then a crossing time later, you'll have had a new bunch of shocks generated, which will create a bunch of new dense objects, and then those can collapse. So here is a really, really simple energy argument for where this sort of 1% comes from. All right, so here is my molecular cloud, and this can be either a giant molecular cloud, or it could be a much smaller cloud that's going to form a single star cluster. All right, so I'm not going to specify right now how big this is. But I am going to note that on its largest scale, it's roughly virialized. That is, this alpha, the virial parameter, is about 1. And alpha is, roughly speaking, the ratio of kinetic energy to potential energy. And I'm also going to tell you something I know about supersonic isothermal turbulence. And this can be understood from first principles. It's seen in simulations. It's a reasonably well-understood property, which is that it obeys what's called a line-width size relation. That is, the velocity dispersion you measure in a box of a given size L depends on the size of that box L. Small boxes have small velocity dispersions. Larger regions have larger velocity dispersions. And it goes as the size of the box to roughly the 1/2 power. All right, and the way I've written down this normalization, I've introduced this lambda S, that's the sonic scale. That is, the size of a box such that the non-thermal velocity dispersion is roughly equal to the sound speed. All right, and that's just a way of normalizing this relation. So now what does this imply? Well, let's think about energies. Let's pick some random region within this molecular cloud whose size is L. Well, the mass within that region is going to be like L cubed, right? You know, it's a random region, so the mass is just proportional to the volume, which is like L cubed. The kinetic energy is like m sigma squared, and sigma is like L to the 1/2, so m sigma squared is like L to the 4th power. The potential energy is like m squared over r, or m squared over L. It's like L to the 5th power. So what does that mean? Well, it means that if kinetic energy and potential energy are equal for this entire giant cloud, then in this small subregion, the kinetic energy is much bigger than the potential energy, which means that this small subregion of the cloud is gravitationally unbound. And that's exactly what you see in those simulations. Now, if I go back to this simulation, and I were to just draw a random box within this cloud, what I would find is that it would be gravitationally unbound by orders of magnitude. There'd be much more kinetic energy than potential energy. All right, now let's turn this around. I'm going to make a hypothesis. My hypothesis is that star formation only occurs in regions that are unusual, that are denser than average, and in particular that are sufficiently dense that their potential energy is actually greater than their kinetic energy. That is, they are gravitationally bound. And it turns out that that's equivalent to the statement that the thermal pressure in this little region is comparable to or greater than the Ram pressure in the ambient cloud. Those two statements are the same. So clearly I have to be denser than average to meet that condition. How much denser than average? Well, it's simple energy arguments and simple algebra to work it out. And it turns out that you can write that condition as the overdensity that's required is such that the local genes length, lambda j, has to be smaller than the sonic length of the turbulence. All right, that is, I need a region that's so dense, and the denser I get, the smaller the genes length is. I need a region where the genes length is smaller than the sonic length of the turbulence. So this is a little convenient, and here's why it's convenient. I'm going to tell you a second thing I know about turbulence. I know that supersonic isothermal turbulence, which is what we think is going on in a giant molecular cloud, generates a particular probability distribution function of densities, a PDF of densities. And what I mean by that is that if I take my supersonic isothermal turbulent cloud and I stick a probe at a random position within it and I ask, what's the density at that point? And then I do that a bunch of times at random points, I will measure a distribution of densities that has this particular form. It's a log normal distribution. That is, it's a Gaussian in the log of density. Now, the nice thing is, I know what the density distribution looks like. It looks like this. And I know what counts as dense enough that it's going to be gravitationally bound. It's everything to the right of this dashed line. This is the line at which the gene's length equals the sonic length. And so if I want to know what the star formation rate is, well, I do an integral. I integrate how much mass in the distribution is to the right of this line. The star formation rate is that fraction of the mass per free fall time, up to a factor of order unity. And in fact, you can see how it depends on these two parameters describing the turbulence, the virial ratio and the Mach number. Here's just a little cartoon. As I raise the virial ratio, that is, I put more and more kinetic energy into the flow, I need to be denser and denser in order to be bound. And as I change the Mach number, that both causes this to move to the right and increases the width of the distribution. All right, and so when I do the integral for an arbitrary value of alpha on the Mach number, I can actually write it down as an error function, but since we're astronomers, we like power laws, and this is a good fit to it. This is the star formation rate per free fall time. Now, here's the cute thing. We know that the regions that form stars are supersonic, so a typical Mach number might be 30. And we know that they're roughly virialized observationally, so alpha is about 1, which means that the star formation rate per free fall time is about a few percent in any turbulent virialized object, which is very convenient because that's what we saw observationally. Independent of density, the amount of mass that went into stars per free fall time is of order a percent. So this seems to be an explanation for that. So let's go on to the second lesson. Feedback matters. All right. So what do I want to say about feedback? So first of all, I wanted to point out that, as I mentioned before, supernovae are probably not the important feedback mechanism here. And that is that if you look at star clusters forming today, the action is all over before the first supernova goes off. All right. So there simply isn't time for supernovae to do anything interesting. Now, for globular clusters, that is probably also the case, just from the fact that there's no dispersion in metallicity. And if you had supernovae going off while the cluster was still forming, the stars that formed after the supernova would presumably be metal-enriched compared to the stars that went off before the supernova. And you can actually make the same chemical argument for galactic star clusters. They are chemically homogeneous to such a degree that you cannot tolerate even a single supernova going off. Even in giant molecular clouds, which are sort of larger and looser things that live maybe 30 million years, supernovae only occur after the stars in question have left the cloud. And that's because each star sets off a bubble of ionization around itself and blows away the gas in its immediate vicinity. So by the time it explodes, the molecular cloud is no longer around it. And so instead, we have to focus on sort of three sources of feedback that are a lot more immediate, that is, that go off immediately. Protostellar outflows, ionizing radiation, and non-ionizing or thermal radiation. So let's start with outflows. So to sort of set the baseline, I will show a movie that I'm sure 95% of the people in this room have seen. This is a sort of famous Bunnell Baden-Vine simulation of the formation of a star cluster. So this is the sort of baseline. This is what you get if the only physics you put into your problem is hydrodynamics and gravity, and you pretend that stars don't shine and they don't send out outflows. And that, you know, your star cluster is purely isolated. All right, so this is sort of the baseline. And you can see you get these nice stars forming in clusters. You get all these n-body interactions and things being sort of sprayed off in every direction. You get these little subclusters that form and then merge with one another. These guys still have the best graphics in the field, by the way. Nothing else I'm going to show you is anywhere near this pretty. So, you know, it's all downhill from here. All right, so this is what life looks like if you pretend that stars don't have any feedback.
Hold on, in yeah. terms of turbulence and initial condition and all that, what was going on?
So they started with a sphere of gas where they put in some initial turbulence. All right, so they seeded this cloud with turbulent motions, but then didn't do anything. So you basically get one generation of shocks, and then all the turbulence decays away.
But it's still consistent with 1% that you talked about.
No, it's not even close to consistent. I'll show you that in a second. The star formation rate here winds up being way too high.
But that's only initial condition, right?
Well, no, the reason is that the turbulence decays away. So in this simulation, you know, it starts out turbulent, but the decay time for the turbulence is only about a crossing time. So it's turbulent for the first crossing time, and then all the turbulence decays, and then the star formation rate gets to be way too high.
Because
there's nothing to drive the turbulent motions, because it's pure hydro with no feedback. So here's a simulation that starts with a very, very similar initial condition, but where they put in the fact that stars have outflows. There's Lee and Nakamura. And you see it's very, very similar initially. There's turbulence and you start forming stars, but you'll notice every time stars start forming, the gas around them sort of gets blown away. And the interesting thing you'll notice here is that this is running for about as long in terms of dynamical times as the last simulation I showed you, but the density isn't dropping like crazy. In that last simulation I showed you, by the time the simulation was over, half the mass was gone into stars. In this simulation, on the other hand, I mean, look at the color scale. The color scale isn't changing. Even at the end of it, you've still got most of the mass in gas. And that's because the outflows keep the turbulence going. And you can show this very clearly. So here is just a plot for that simulation of the kinetic energy and the gravitational potential energy versus time. So the solid line here is the kinetic energy. All right, and they started out with a lot of kinetic energy, and then the turbulence decays. You see it coming down. But then all of a sudden, they start forming stars, and stars have outflows. And you get all these spikes. And what you see is that the kinetic energy asymptotes to a roughly constant value. It's a value that's, in fact, in rough equipartition with the gravitational potential energy. And so the turbulence here, rather than decaying, is constant. And because of that, the star formation rate is much lower. So if you put these two simulations on that plot I showed you before, so here's the one by Bunnell et al., and you'll see it's up here at a star formation rate of like 20 or 30% per freefall time, which is radically in disagreement with the observations. On the other hand, that simulation I just showed you by Lee and Nakamura is down here below 10%, and actually some more recent work they've done that has a better model of the outflows brings it down even more. And so what you can see is that you can get something compatible with the observations and compatible with this idea of turbulence regulating the star formation if you remember that stars have outflows.
Yes. Do you have to start with a turbulence spectrum in this gas cloud, or if you start without turbulence, will be self-regulating with this impact?
If you started with zero turbulence, it would probably, so it depends on the initial density structure you started with. It probably, if you started out with something where there was some initial density structure, so say parts of it would collapse before other parts, that probably would generate turbulence. If you started with a purely uniform cloud, with no density structure, no velocity structure. In fact, the solution to that problem is known analytically, and the analytic solution is the entire cloud arrives at a singularity at the origin at the same instant. So no, in that case, you would not get self-regulation.
So what drives the turbulence then on a much larger scale, like if you look at the disk of the galaxy? Is it also all the back from the...
So if you look at the entire disk of the galaxy, outflows are not significant on larger scales. If you look at the entire disk of the galaxy, supernovae are probably a contributor. Another contributor may be just galactic shear. Basically, in the end, you're tapping the gravitational energy of the galaxy. Thermal instability can do it. So that is that if you talk about atomic gas, it has a thermal instability that can cause turbulent motions. So all of those things may contribute. But none of those are significant sort of in the molecular gas out of which a star cluster forms.
So those are basically the initial conditions of these simulations. Like they start off with some turbulence, which is the...
Which is imposed from the galactic scale. That's right.
Yeah.
But what about cloud collisions? Can they drive turbulence?
If they occur frequently enough, yes. And if you can keep the clouds moving with respect to one another fast enough, yes. All right, but again, you need, you know, the ultimate energy source for that is going to be basically galactic shear. I mean, that's what's going to be accelerating the clouds and making them run into one another. So, all right, that's outflows. Now, if you want to look at a somewhat larger scale, and it's not clear to me how important this is for sort of star clusters. It's certainly dominant on GMC scales. There, H2 regions are probably the most likely source of feedback. All right, and part of the reason I say this is that on a GMC scale, outflows simply don't give you enough energy. The outflows are typically only a parsec or two long, and a giant molecular cloud is something like 30 or 40 parsecs in size. The outflows are just too small. So instead, you need something like, well, this giant H2 region. And the reason I say that is that we observe that the lifetime of a giant molecular cloud is something like 30 million years, and the crossing time, the time for the turbulence to decay, is more like 5 million years. So the fact that giant molecular clouds don't turn completely into stars in 5 million years tells you there has to be something that's sort of keeping the turbulence going. And H2 regions are the most likely candidate. So here's sort of how this works. This is a simulation done that I did using the Athena MHD code with an ionizing radiative transfer module. So the red is the ionized gas, the blue is the neutral gas, and you're just seeing two different slices. And you can see that when I set off an ionizing bubble, it expands, and then it sort of drives motion out into the surrounding cloud, here, for example. All right, you can play that again. So initially it expands, and then you see the shell of dense material is built up, and it sort of pushes on the surrounding gas that still stays neutral, but it gets pushed around by the pressure of this ionized gas. And what's going on here is actually pretty simple. This gas out here has a sound speed of about 0.2 kilometers per second. It's at a temperature of 10 Kelvin, it's molecular, it's very cold. The gas inside that bubble, on the other hand, has a sound speed of about 10 kilometers a second. It's ionized, it's at a temperature of 10 to the 4. So it's basically a bomb. It's hugely overpressured compared to the gas around it, and so it induces all these motions. So that's a simulation of how this works, but that simulation is sort of a single ionized region. It isn't an entire GMC.
What would have set off the ionization in that region?
The formation of a massive star. Okay. Massive stars generate bubbles of ionization around them. Oh, yes, that's what causes all this ionization. So here is a sort of cartoon model of how this is going to work out for sort of the energy balance in a GMC. All right, and so the idea is I can write down the non-equilibrium virial theorem and the non-equilibrium energy equation for just a spherical cloud, and I'm just going to keep track of the energy budget. And so there's energy gains via these little bombs going off, and there are energy losses via the fact that, well, the turbulence is constantly decaying. And it's decaying because you get shocks. The shocks raise the gas temperature, but then that gas radiates away its excess energy very, very quickly. And that's sort of, so the cloud is constantly leaking energy. All right, and here are just some outcomes of these semi-analytic models. And these lines are just different runs from the same initial conditions, and the only difference between them is that I drew stars from the IMF differently. All right, and what you can see is that the virial ratio of this cloud, rather than running away because the cloud is collapsing, stays at around 1. And in fact, that's what we observe for giant molecular clouds. So here is an observational plot of virial ratio versus cloud mass, roughly. So here are things that are non-star forming and non-virialized, and giant molecular clouds, the things that actually make stars, all live here at a virial ratio of about 1. So that's consistent. You also see that the column densities of these clouds stay about constant. They stay at around 10 to the 22 hydrogen atoms per square centimeter, and that's because they start to contract some as their turbulence decays, but then they form stars. And that star formation drives turbulent motions, which puffs the cloud back out, and the process repeats. And indeed, if you look at the surface densities of observed giant molecular clouds, they all hover around this value. And so again, it's consistent. And the star formation rate in these clouds, as parameterized by that depletion time, also stays about constant. All right, so that's a second source of feedback. Here's a third one to think about. Thermal feedback. All right, so this is from radiation that's not ionizing. And the reason to think about this is that the accretion luminosity onto a low-mass protostar can be truly impressive. A 0.1 solar mass star can put out 100 L sun in accretion power while it's growing. All right, and this is just the gravitational potential energy of the stuff falling onto it. And this is by far the dominant energy source in a star-forming region. I mean, if you just do the energy budget, and I've got my star-forming molecular cloud, and I ask, where's most of the energy? It's mostly in the radiation put out by protostellar outflow, or by protostellar radiation from accretion power. Now, the significance of this is that heat affects how gas fragments, because after all, the fragmentation scale is set by the Jeans mass, and the Jeans mass depends on the temperature of the gas. So if I heat up the gas, then that's going to change how it fragments into stars. And so here is just a very simple cartoony calculation I did showing the temperature structure in a 50 solar mass cloud of gas that's collapsing. So this red dashed line is the temperature immediately before the star forms. And you see it's, you know, 10 Kelvin and maybe a little warmer on the inside. These two blue lines show the temperature of the gas at the point where the star is 0.05 solar masses and 0.8 solar masses. And what you can see is that there's this bubble of warm gas around the star being powered by accretion. All right, out at, you know, 1,000 AU, the temperature is 100 Kelvin. And 100 Kelvin gas fragments very, very differently than 10 Kelvin gas. All right, the genes mass goes like temperature to the 3/2 power. So if I change the temperature by a factor of 10, I've changed the characteristic fragment mass by a factor of 30. So that means it's very, very difficult for fragments to form in this region. And that affects the IMF. So if you really want to understand this process, you have to do simulations. And so this is some very nice work done by Stella Offner, and I should, full disclosure, I'm one of the et al. In there, as part of her thesis. And so the calculation is as follows. You start with sort of identical initial conditions. You start with a box of gas, and here's just the projected density. All right? And then you run the simulation twice. You run it once with just hydrodynamics and gravity, and you run it a second time, including radiative transfer, and as part of that, you have the feedback from the stars that form in the simulation. And this was done with the Orion Adaptive Mesh Refinement Radiation Hydrodynamics Code. So that's the initial condition. Here's the outcome. So on the left here is the results if you pretend that stars don't radiate. And on the right here is the results if you remember that they do. And this is the corresponding distribution of temperatures in the simulation, a projected temperature. And you see that on the large scale, there's not actually that much difference. I mean, the arrangement of the gas isn't that different. But on small scales, there clearly are differences. So, for example, in the no radiative transfer simulation, you've got all these knots of high density here and here and here, and there aren't corresponding structures there. And what's going on is that the gas there has been warmed up by star formation, and that warming has made it hard for it to collapse. It has just raised the pressure. And so if you look statistically at the stars that come out of this, well, you see things like, if you do the simulation without radiation, you get more brown dwarfs than stars. All right, so the blue line is without radiation, the red line is with it, and it's number of stars versus mass. What you can see is that in the blue, your sort of IMF peaks in the brown dwarf regime. The typical object that forms is a brown dwarf and not a star. If you do radiation, all of a sudden, you actually get stars as the typical objects of star formation. Similarly, if you look at the multiplicity of the things that form, the run without radiation produces significantly more binaries and some triple systems, whereas the run with radiation gets more single stars, which is actually appropriate in this case because for low-mass stars, as all of these are, most of them are in fact born single. These are sort of M stars, and the typical M star is a single, not a binary.
What's N total? What's the total number of objects?
In this simulation, it's, well, let's see, we can count. It's not a lot. So it's, in the radiative simulation, it looks like it's 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, so it's a border 10. In the non-radiative simulation, it's a little more. All right, and in fact, it's a lot more in the non-radiative simulation because, of course, you get lots and lots of fragmentation down to little things.
Can you explain this result? It's not clear to me why the radiation is going, the presence of radiation is going in the direction of increasing the fraction of the high mass stars.
Well, basically, it's because it's reducing the ability of low-mass stars to form. So it's not so much that it's making stars more massive. It's the opposite. It's that it's preventing low-mass things from collapsing because I've got some little low-mass blob of gas that's next to another star.
So preventing accretion is not important because I thought that preventing further accretion by radiation stopped the formation more.
That's something. So it turns out that actually doesn't work, but it's not even relevant at these mass scales. I mean, radiation pressure inhibiting accretion is not something that one needs to worry about below about 20 solar masses. So I have an entire talk about that subject, but I will not give it now. All right.
It's relevant for some range of masses.
It's relevant for stars that are sort of 20 solar masses and up. It turns out actually not to work even for them, but all right. So this sort of leads me into my third point, which is variation of the IMF. And there's a question mark there because this is by far the most speculative part of the talk. Take with large grain of salt. All right. So what I will say is that if you look at local star clusters, you basically don't see any variation in the mass distribution. That is, things where you can actually count the stars, the stellar mass peak is always in the same place. However, that's mostly a technique you use to probe the peak of the IMF. And that's just because there aren't nearby very many massive clusters, which is what you'd need if you wanted to count stars and constrain the high mass end of the IMF, just because those stars are very rare. And if you want to tell the difference between, well, just statistically, I didn't happen to form any 20 solar mass stars, and for some physical reason, I couldn't form any 20 solar mass stars, you need a lot of statistical power to do that. And the nearby sample doesn't provide enough statistical power. So instead, you have to use indirect evidence. And there is circumstantial evidence from local galaxies for variation at the top end of the IMF. And the dependence of the IMF on radiation suggests a physical mechanism that might be responsible for this sort of variation. So let me first tell you about the circumstantial evidence. It basically comes from ratios of H-alpha to FUV radiation. So for those non-star formation aficionados, let me walk you through how this works. H-alpha is basically a byproduct of ionization. H-alpha line radiation is what comes out of an ionized region through the recombination process. And so the H-alpha flux that you get from a stellar population is more or less just directly proportional to the rate at which that stellar population produces ionizing radiation. And ionizing radiation comes primarily from very, very massive stars because you need a high surface temperature to produce a lot of ionizing photons. The sort of, for a standard Krupa-type IMF, the half-mass point, that is, the mass point above which half the ionizing radiation is coming from, is about 45 solar masses. Now, another way of measuring star formation rates or looking at young stars is FUV radiation. This is radiation that's in the ultraviolet, but below the ionization threshold for hydrogen. So this can be produced still by massive stars, but by somewhat less massive, stars that are hot but not quite as hot. The half-mass point for FUV is about 15 solar masses. Now, the nice thing is that since both 45 and 15 solar mass stars are relatively short-lived, unless the star formation rate in a galaxy is fluctuating on timescales much less than 100 million years, which is difficult to arrange because, I mean, the galactic dynamical time is considerably more than 100 million years, the ratio of H-alpha radiation to FUV radiation should basically just depend on the IMF. It should just depend on the number of 15 solar mass stars versus the number of 50 solar mass stars. In other words, it should be this blue line. Now, here's the interesting thing. Galaxies that are reasonably high surface brightness, so this is the R-band surface brightness versus this H-alpha to FUV ratio for a sample of H1 selected nearby galaxies, do hover around this blue line. On the other hand, low surface brightness galaxies seem to fall significantly below it. And it's very hard to arrange to do that by anything other than messing with the IMF. For example, if you think dust is involved, well, these are dust reddening vectors. And unless you think that these low surface brightness galaxies are a factor of 10 more reddened than these considerably more massive, nominally more dusty galaxies, dust won't do it. So it's very hard to explain this result without saying the IMF is varying. I'm not saying it's impossible. This is circumstantial evidence, but it's hard. And you can see similar things in other samples.
And under sampling, or different cluster mass function, can do it?
Well, this is looking at entire galaxies. So, right.
If the low surface brightness galaxies form mostly smaller clusters, so you have never sampled the...
So then the question is, so one way you could try and arrange to do this is to say that for some reason, in fact, the IMF depends on the cluster mass function, and these small galaxies only form small clusters.
That's right, in the obvious sense that many of the Krupa papers, that if you form the overall IMF from clusters, then how you break up initially the star formation into clusters will obviously affect...
Well, that depends. I mean, it is not the case for any of these galaxies that a significant fraction of the clusters are less than, say, 200 solar masses. Even for the very low surface brightness ones, the typical cluster mass is not below 200 solar masses. And so then the question is, so the most massive star that I ever form, the cluster is large enough to form that. And so then the question is, suppose I form 200 solar mass clusters.
Wait, 200, how big do you need to get populated way up to the 45 that sets the H-alpha?
So that's the question. The question is, suppose I formed 1,200,000 solar mass clusters. Would it be the case that when I added them together, I got the IMF? That is, the typical 200 solar mass cluster won't have a 45 solar mass star in it, but if I roll the dice enough times, eventually I will get one. Or is it the case that there's a relationship between the cluster mass and the stellar mass. That is, there's a maximum stellar mass associated with a given cluster mass. Now, Krupa likes to think that there is. And that may well be the case, but I would say there's no good actual evidence for it. There's no physical mechanism to explain it. Krupa gives it solely as a statistical argument. All right, and you know, it's a plausible hypothesis, but there's no physics behind it. It's pure statistics. And so I think it's actually an open question. If I formed 1,200,000 solar mass clusters, would I ever get a 100 solar mass star? Now, that I don't know the answer to that question, and neither does Krupa. He hypothesizes that the answer is no, and he may well be right. But there's no physics there. It's all statistics.
Just to remind us, what for standard IMF, what total cluster mass do you need to have a probability of at least, say, 50% to get stars above 45 solar mass?
I'm not sure I can do that integral in my head, but my guess is I guess it's around 1,000.
Really?
Yeah. Is it more than that?
A lot more.
10,000? Okay. I can't do that integral in my head.
No, that's why I said, yeah. We're not talking hundreds.
I understand that. But then it's a question of, is it the case that my 100 or my 1,000 solar mass cluster will never form 100 solar mass star? Because
your length of turbulence be connected somehow to the overall size of the cluster, and your length of turbulence limits your star mass?
Possibly. I mean, I do not believe that we know well enough what controls the maximum stellar mass to say this with confidence. All right, let me put it that way. I am not convinced by any argument that anyone's given me thus far of why you couldn't form a 100 solar mass star in a 200 solar mass cluster. As opposed to, you're unlikely to. There's a difference between it's unlikely and it is forbidden by the laws of physics.
But this is observationally testable because you don't need 1,000,000 solar mass clusters. You only need a few hundred.
And
if you ever see a 45 solar mass star essentially by itself,
right,
then you haven't got
it. Right. So what I will say is that there do appear to be a population of O stars that are neither runaways nor members of clusters. It's small, and you worry a lot about observational selection effects. And you worry about, could it be that, this O star just so happens that its velocity is not along my line of sight, so I can't see it in the Doppler direction, and for whatever reason, it's hard for me to measure its space velocity. So I think it's not a runaway, but really it is. So, yes, it's in principle observationally testable, but it's a very hard observation to make.
So that's an extreme case, right? Looking for the isolated O star. I think people like Sally Hui have looked at the ensembles of O stars.
Right, in the SMC, and
it seems perfectly explainable by just
right.
sampling.
Exactly. So Sally Hui's data suggests that, in fact, there is no law of physics against forming a 100 solar mass star in a 200 solar mass cluster. All right? What she says is that in the SMC, the data are consistent with the cluster mass function continuing all the way down to a single O star. Other people analyzing other samples statistically have come to different conclusions. And so it's a very hard observation. It's a question that can be answered observationally. It's just a hard one to answer observationally.
So it's consistent with forming one O star. Is it inconsistent with the reverse hypothesis?
What do you mean? Is it inconsistent with the idea that you couldn't form an isolated O star? She would say yes, but again, it's, she would say yes, and other people looking at the exact same data would give you the opposite answer.
Can I ask, so in your simulations, including all the effects, etc., do you see that massive stars, they form directly from fragmentation, or they do form some of them through collisions even in your simulations?
No, they form through fragmentation. In fact, thank you for giving me the segue. You were rescuing me, yes. Okay, the opposite end of the spectrum. This sample does not include any starbursts just because it doesn't go far enough.
Where would they be?
Starbursts, it's very difficult to answer that question because almost no H-alpha gets out of them. They're so dusty that the dust correction, these are all galaxies for which the dust correction is sort of, a magnitude. In a starburst, the dust correction is, 20 magnitudes. And so you just can't answer the question. None of the H-alpha gets out.
How would the Milky Way be here?
The Milky Way is, sort of there-ish. This is an H1 selected sample for the nearby universe. So the vast majority of the things in this sample are little dwarfy things, just because it's a volume limited H1 selected sample.
So you said the lowest, but still the typical masses for a cluster are 200 solar masses. which are in this sample.
Oh yeah, no. So
if you have kind of a power law or a distribution for the cluster initial mass function, then you would expect also a large number of clusters even at lower mass.
Oh yeah, no.
No reason.
200 was a rough number. Let me put it this way.
It's observation.
No. Observationally, let me put it this way. In order to, so you could ask, do I have enough star formation that I'd expect there to be an O star present at any given time? And the answer to that question, even for the things here with the lowest star formation rates, is yes. All right. I do not know off the top of my head what the cluster mass function is in these galaxies. I don't think that it's actually known. These are integrated measurements. So this is not spatially resolved. This is, you know, you take your telescope beam and you measure all the H alpha photons coming out of the galaxy. These are not resolved at the level that you can see individual, you know, 50 solar mass clusters and start to try and count them.
Sure. No, my question was rather going into this direction. If you actually extrapolate down the cluster mass function, you eventually end up at clusters being kind of 40 solar masses.
Sure.
And then the question is, can a 40 solar mass cluster form a 45 solar mass star?
Right. The answer is clearly no, but that effect, well, right.
If you ask Bruce Evergreen, he would be not so sure about
it. All right. Well, the answer, though, doesn't really matter, and the reason it doesn't matter is that because the cluster mass function is dn dm goes as m to the minus 2, that is equal mass per logarithmic bin, there's so little mass in the things below 100 solar masses that they don't, you know, they wouldn't change the integrated H alpha for the galaxy.
They would change the number of
they would not change it significantly, is what I'm saying, because there's so little mass in them that, you know, yes, there are fewer massive stars because, you know, some of your total stellar masses and things below 100 solar masses, but that's, you know, less than, you know, that's only 5% of the mass.
Well, gets you this kind of steepening at the high mass end, which might be consistent.
It is nowhere near large enough to explain this result.
Okay.
If your statement was that the maximum stellar mass was equal to the cluster mass, that would not provide anywhere near this level of effect.
Okay, what IMF would you need to get to this result?
Well, you need to, I mean, looking at this, you need to suppress the H alpha compared to FUV by looks like factors of, you know, of order 3 or something. So you basically need to not form any stars, period, bigger than about 40 solar masses. That would be one way of doing it. Or you could steepen the power law. That would do it, too. All right. So in this paper, they have plot. If you want to see, they have plots of what do you have to do to the IMF to fit this data. All right. No going back. So what does this imply about the IMF and fragmentation? So the question came up, how do massive stars form? And the answer is, collisions does not seem to be a significant process. The stellar densities are not high enough in the galaxy. All right, the densities you see in young clusters in the galaxy are simply not high enough that stars run into one another at any significant rate. All right, that may be different for globular clusters, it may be different for superstar clusters, but in the galaxy where we see massive stars forming, collisions are not a viable mechanism. It has to be direct collapse. And here's the problem. The genes mass in star-forming clouds, as I said, is about a solar mass. And so if I've got a massive core, you know, something that can make a 100 solar mass star, that's 100 genes masses. Why doesn't it fragment into little bits? And in fact, if you do a pure hydrodynamic simulation, that's the result you get. So here's one from Dobbs et al. And this is the Bunnell code. So it's hydro plus gravity only. And they started with a massive core, and, you know, this is what they got. They got a lot of little stars and no big ones. But again, you need to actually remember that stars radiate and check this result with radiation hydro. So here is a nearly identical initial condition done with radiation hydro. So here's my whole cloud. This is a zoom in around the most massive star. You see a star form there. Now, here's the thing. There's no star forming there. There's a little lump of gas, but no star formed. Still only one star in the simulation. There's a second. That's an actual star. All right. In the disk here, a third one forms. You're not getting a lot of fragmentation. And what's going on here is that the radiation is suppressing it. So I can do the exact same simulation again, do the trick of just turn off the radiation transfer in my code, and do the exact same simulation from identical initial conditions, and here's the comparison. So these are two simulations with identical running times and identical initial conditions. Here's my simulation with radiation, and you notice I have a binary. Here's my simulation without radiation. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stars there, and there's more off the frame.
Is this a zero spin core?
What was that?
Is the specific angular momentum zero?
No. The way the angular momentum is generated is I generate a Gaussian random turbulent velocity field that I give the core initially, and that Gaussian random velocity field has some angular momentum in it just as a result of random chance.
And some very small net spin.
Yes. The net spin is, in terms of, so the way we parameterize this in the star formation community is beta, which is the ratio of the kinetic energy in rotation to the gravitational binding energy. That number is about
2%. Is that translated
in lambda? I'm certainly not doing that in my head.
This is T over W.
It's T rotation over W. So T over W is about 1. Huh?
T over W is about 0.02, is that what you said?
If T is the rotational component only. So T over W, if you include all the kinetic energy, is about 1.
Of course.
Right. So...
Okay, so you but things like bars and things like that would show up at T over W of 0.1.
Right. So this is below that.
So this
yeah.
is basically non-rotating in terms of...
Exactly.
Significant
exactly, but because it collapses so far, I mean, you see you do form a disk, because it collapses to by much more than a factor of 100 in length scale. I mean, so this simulation had an effective resolution of about 10,000 cubed using the AMR. So the bottom line is, with radiative transfer, you get few fragments, and without it, you get many fragments, and your disk breaks up, you get all sorts of interesting things, but what you don't get is, you know, a plausible way of making massive stars. And so in order to make massive stars, you seem to rely on radiation inhibiting fragmentation. So suppose I think that this is a necessary condition for making massive stars. Well, in order to make a massive star, then I have to be able to take my 100 solar masses of gas, and I need to heat it throughout. If I only heat the inner little bit of it, that won't stop it from fragmenting. So what has to be true for that to work? Well, for a gas cloud, I can ask, what is the condition necessary to heat it throughout? And it turns out that for a given surface density, there is a critical light-to-mass ratio that's required. That is, if I stick a source of light in the center of a cloud of a certain surface density, and I say, what's required to heat this cloud, I need a certain light-to-mass ratio. And in solar units, you see at low surface densities, it's like 10, and at a higher surface density, it drops. And that's easy to understand physically. Low surface density means I've got a big radiating area. It's very easy to shed radiation, and so I need a lot of light to keep my gas warm. High surface density means small radiating area for the same mass, and so the cloud has a lot more trouble shedding radiation, and so I need less light. So I get this sort of critical light-to-mass ratio, A to halt, that's required to turn off the fragmentation. Now, what light-to-mass ratio do I actually get? Well, I already told you the dominant source of energy in these things before a massive star forms is just accretion luminosity from the low-mass stars. Here's what I get from that. These blue lines are eta accretion. And you can see that this is an increasing function of surface density, and the reason it's an increasing function is that the denser my cloud, the faster it collapses into low-mass stars, and therefore the higher the accretion rate, and thus the more light I get out, higher luminosity. So there's this crossover point, and it slightly depends on the mass of the star or the mass of the cloud, but not by much. So here's my hypothesis. I only make massive stars in clouds that are to the right of this crossover point. So I can solve for a critical surface density required to make massive stars, a threshold. It's about 1 gram per square centimeter. This is very convenient for me because the typical massive star cluster where you see a massive star has a surface density of about 1 gram per square centimeter. Lower surface density clusters are not observed to contain massive stars. So, what are the implications for the IMF? Well, as I said, this is where you see massive stars, but by ISM standards, this is an extraordinarily high surface density. The typical giant molecular cloud in the Milky Way has a surface density about 50 times lower than that. Getting to this high density requires a high pressure, and that's just because pressure is roughly g times the surface density squared. So that's p over k of about 10 to the 8th Kelvin per cubic centimeter. In contrast, if you go to a random point in the Milky Way's disk, the pressure is about 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 Kelvin per cubic centimeter. So this is hugely overpressured, and low surface brightness galaxies may not have enough gas in them to reach this threshold pressure. You simply need a lot of weight to compress the ISM that much, and that may make them make fewer massive stars. And other environments may reach this threshold more easily and get more massive stars. Now, big caveat, this is outright speculation. All right, there is very little physics to back this up. It's just suggestive. So I will end on that speculative note with my summary. Star formation is a slow process. It's slow in every single environment we can observe, in every tracer we have used. There is zero evidence for a star formation rate that is more than a few percent per freefall time. It has never been seen. And that's probably because all of these systems are dominated by supersonic turbulence. And that supersonic turbulence sets an upper limit on how quickly you can put mass into stars of about that rate. And feedback is the key to this, because feedback from non-supernova sources is what drives the turbulence. And it's also probably important for setting the IMF. It controls how the gas fragments. And as a result of this, the IMF might actually vary. Different density environments are affected by this radiation-inhibiting fragmentation process in different ways. And that means there may be variation of the IMF. It's mostly going to be at the high mass end, because that's where you're most dependent on this radiation-inhibiting fragmentation process. Although it may affect brown dwarfs, too. Of course, brown dwarfs don't really shine enough that you can see them in extragalactic circumstances. So I will end there. Thank you. Other questions? Or is everyone exhausted? Desperate for coffee?
So your conditions for making the massive star in the speculative part, does it also predict something for the environment? So as to say, are you still physically able to make an isolated star without anything around it? Or does this environment have to be so dense that you basically populate the full IMF and a single massive star gives you another 2,000 low mass stars right around it?
I would suspect that you probably do need some low-mass stars to accompany a high-mass star, but actually what I bet is that what happens is that you do need low-mass stars around it, but in the immediate vicinity of the massive star, you probably want to put actually fewer low-mass stars. So massive stars will always form in clusters, but if you look at where the low-mass stars are around it, you'll see the low-mass stars sort of rising toward the center and then actually dipping down because formation of low-mass stars gets suppressed by the radiation of the massive star. But that's, again, speculation.
Oh, man, I was hoping we could use that as a global cluster initial condition.
You're welcome to put it into your models. Just don't blame me. Yeah, I mean, what we need to do is actually simulate the formation of entire massive star clusters, including the sort of full calculation of radiative feedback. And right now, that's just not something that we've been able to do. It's numerically too hard. You know, you saw a calculation where we included the protostellar radiation. We formed like 20 stars. So if you want to do a bigger one, it's a lot of computer time. And there are people who are doing a sort of intermediate thing where they're including radiation from, they're including radiative transfer for gas that's compressing, but not the radiation actually output by the stars. And that is sort of a halfway step, and it's much easier computationally because, of course, you're leaving out 90% of the energy, and so your radiative solver has to work a lot less hard.
Have you thought about doing this for much larger systems using sort of much more approximate simulations where you would do, basically you wouldn't resolve the individual star formation. Mm-hmm. You would do something that looks more like an n-body simulation, but with detailed prescriptions on the large scales for all these feedbacks that you think are there. Sort of a bit like people do for galaxy formation,
right,
but on smaller scales and with a lot more detailed physics.
Right. So I've thought about that some. So, for example, I'm working on a project right now, or I should say I have a student working on a project in collaboration with Mordecai McLowe, where we're trying to simulate entire galaxies. And we have regions of the galaxy that go into collapse. And this is stuff that Mordecai has done before. And they can't resolve the individual collapsing regions. They sort of say, I formed a giant molecular cloud. It's going into collapse. I can't resolve it at that point. And what they've done in the past is said, well, OK, we form a sink particle there and forget about it. What we're doing is basically taking those sink particles and hooking them up to that semi-analytic model for giant molecular cloud evolution so that rather than just forming a dead sink particle that sits there as just a point mass for the rest of the simulation, we actually say, well, all right, some fraction of the mass will get turned into stars, some fraction of it, the vast majority, gets blown back into the ISM, and so we can actually do the simulation with gas return and where we actually, you know something about not just where the molecular cloud formed, but then how it moved in the galaxy and where the stars formed along that trajectory.
I was thinking of something, now you jumped all the way to the scale, but forming an individual superstar cluster.
Right.
Dissolving all the individual stars, putting in all the physics at the level of the individual stars, but without actually resolving the hydro on the scale of the individual stars.
I can't say that I've given a tremendous amount of thought to doing something like that. I think it is doable. I mean, a challenge here is that there's a reason I showed you three simulations for those three different effects, outflows, ionization, and thermal radiation, and that's because there is no code that includes them all. We are working on putting them all into codes, but right now, you know, it's sort of some guy goes out and puts outflows in, someone else goes and does ionization, and a third person goes and does thermal radiation. And
but even when you have that code that has everything, it will still be doing 20 stars and not a million.
That's probably true, yes. Right, so it would be a question of trying to come up with good prescriptions, and that probably requires doing the 20-star simulations over a wide enough parameter space that we can sort of figure out how things behave as a function of parameter. So, I mean, that calculation of what you need to form a massive star is sort of an example of that.
Is that true? So the obvious question I have asked you before, I'm sure, is could it still be that superstar clusters really form in a different way that's more...
Right. Right. So I think it's difficult to explain because certainly, you know, with that HCN data, we're probing starburst galaxies. I mean, so yes, those aren't necessarily individual superstar clusters, but we are looking at starburst galaxies. And, you know, if there were any place that the zero feedback picture were going to work, that would be it. And yet they form stars at the same rate in this normalized sense as everything else. So we haven't seen the systems, I'll agree, we haven't seen the systems where you know, globular clusters form, and you could always hypothesize something different. And we don't know what this sort of, you know, star formation rate per unit mass is in an individual, like, you know, one of the antennae superstar clusters. We don't have that data. But, you know, we know of no examples where things form fast in the Baden-Bonnell sense. And, you know, in the absence of any data that such a thing is possible, I'm going to stick with the theory that everything works in the same way. You know, I try not to postulate additional processes until I see at least one example of them.
Turning things around, I mean, we talked a bit about that this morning. Is there anything in this picture, if you wanted to apply it literally to forming a million stars, that and becomes a global cluster, that is really problematic?
Yeah, so here's one thing, and this is something I'm not sure I understand yet. So let me go back to my simulation of ionizing radiation. All right. This thing expands like a bomb. And part of the reason it expands like a bomb is that the velocity dispersion of this blue stuff is less than 10 kilometers a second. All right. That is, the Ram pressure of this ambient stuff is small compared to the thermal pressure in this ionized region. That is not necessarily true for a superstar cluster that's forming, you know, in some external galaxy. If the gas is dense enough and there's enough mass, it may well be the case that the velocity dispersion is large compared to the 10 kilometer per second sound speed that an ionized region generates. So how do these ionized regions work in that case? Clearly, you know, you still get ionization, you'll still have bubbles, but it's not exactly obvious to me how they drive turbulence in that case. I have a model for how turbulent driving occurs in the case of things that are less than 10 kilometers per second. I don't really understand how it works for things that are more than 10 kilometers per second. And clearly, you still get some energy out of the fact that I've just set off this bomb, but how much, I don't know. And what that implies for the sort of formation process. For GMCs, as I said, H2 regions are, I think, the dominant sources of feedback that keep them turbulent. I'm not sure what the dominant sources of feedback are in a superstar cluster. Maybe H2 regions, but it's less obvious.
I can hear quite a couple of